Welcome to the World of Wisdom podcast. My name is Amit Paul, and today we'll get into it. I'm sure we're going to get into it. We'll be talking about things like post-capitalism. I think we'll be talking about my projection. We'll see. It seems like I think I might be talking about some of the energetics of the system, what's running it, and what we can transmute in order to get to somewhere which is not here. And I'm so grateful to have the both of you on the podcast. I heard you on a talk on the Local Futures Conference, and that blew my mind. And I'm just been very curious about your work since. So welcome to the podcast, Lynn Murphy and Alnoor Lada.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Let's see. I think I'm going to stick to my pattern, but let's see if we, you're going to be able to deal with it. I always ask this first question to allow for you to contextualize yourselves. So I'm thinking I'll direct it, the question, but nonetheless, we'll do first one and then the other. But the first question on this podcast is always, who are you, Lynn Murphy?
I don't know. February 7th or whatever day it is, early 2024. I say I don't know, with the I saying sometimes the ego wants to say who I am and locate oneself in whether expertise or field or discipline. And increasingly in my life, I'm more on the don't know mind, and ever apprenticing to the mysteries and the challenges of what it is to walk a spiritual path. And with that, I don't want to be so hubris to say that I have achieved any state of don't know mind. So I'll say I am someone who was raised in the rural areas of the Central Valley, California, in a rather working class environment and in a Pentecostal evangelical one. And those are often things that we see in our world as kind of the problematic of giving rise to the era of Trump and many other things. And within that, a lot of having to decondition what it is to be born as a white woman in these times. The other side has always been committed to a path of service and has always felt the call, if I could say, of the spiritual, even in the years that I put that down and, you know, went to grad school, but saw through the orientation of positivism and objectivity as being truth. Having grown up in one fundamentalism, I was very sensitive to any other fundamentalisms, including when I worked in philanthropy and international development, saw that as another paradigm of objective truth or white savior complex, but ultimately kind of neoliberal imperialism. And so I guess there's a part of me that's always been dedicated to service and has always kind of really tried to stay contextually relevant and recognizing when I was in different institutional straitjackets and how I was complicit in systems. And so I guess I'm a curious wanderer with who's now had the honor to work with Alnoor for the past years, and we'll get into more of what that means, or what that looks like. And worked all over in different domains and with endless curiosity. So I'm grateful to be here today with others who are also ones with endless curiosity and wonder. Yeah.
Lovely. Thank you. So I'll just directed to you, Alnoor. Who are you, Alnoor Lada?
I'm not sure I've reached a state of either, you could say, hubris or arrogance, or on the other side, maybe ignorance, that I could say I know. I think many of us who are on in a spiritual path or grown up in spiritual traditions, I'm trying to, you know, shed the burden and the albatross of identity and the constructs of what who am I means in an Occidental, Western materialist, rationalist paradigm. And try to access the deeper wonder, not simply like the transcendental other, you know, I am the divine or what have you, right? But also the imminent bacteria and you know, the congress of more than human beings that make up my gut biome and my cellular makeup, and deepening my intimacy with that. So in the process of getting to know who I am, and of course the I being in quotations, because it's more a tendency, right? Identity and personality and beingness are kind of constructed tendencies. And I grew up in a Sufi tradition. My tribe are sometimes called the Fatimids or the Ismailis or the Assassin Order. And I sort of renounced my tradition at a very early age, and then sort of adopted a kind of more universal Sufism, you would say. And then I sort of come back to a lot of my traditions and my roots, but I guess from a more like heretical perspective, from a sort of like outside the construct of any institution perspective. And so growing up in a Muslim tradition, you know, similar to Lynn, right? Like we can lay the blame of Western imperialism on the Christian Empire, and there's also you know, the Eastern Empire of the Arab world that has its own shadow and complexities, and of course it was created and mutated through its interaction with Christianity and the cross and the sword and crusades and all of that. But there is a responsibility that comes with being born into one of these major traditions that have shaped the world, you could say for better or worse, but mostly for the worse, I would argue. And there's kind of redemption work in that somehow. And so that's part of, yeah, my exploration of what it means to be a Muslim man in the, you know, the now what would be, I guess, the 11th century of crusades happening, you know, 1100 or 1200 years of this this battle going on, and it's not really getting us anywhere. So
thank you. I'm thinking I'll push this off from by leveraging your book, because it's a nice little lens to look at the world through, perhaps. And I mean, the book, to be correct, has to do with philanthropy in one way or another. But as we talked about before, maybe it has more to do with capitalism and then philanthropy as a specific case of that. So maybe sort of the neoliberal capitalist modern project, whatever that might be on. And there might be more prefixes that one want to put in our time as well. But if I don't know who would want to do it. I'm kind of drawn to point it towards you, Elnor. But if you would try to bring us into the work that you have done, and sort of where it originated and where it's moving, or which direction it's taken.
Mm-hmm. So Lynn and I came at this inquiry from different backgrounds, but ended up in very similar places. You know, Lynn had worked in philanthropy, and I was more of an activist organizer having to deal with philanthropy, right? Most social change work and civil society work is funded by these big foundations. And there's complexities to it that most people who work in NGOs are sheltered from, because there's usually, you know, one, two, or in big organizations, a handful of people that deal with the funders. And as we were going deeper into the structural historical analysis of capitalism and how we got to this moment, it becomes inevitable to see how these two things are connected, right? Because if you get to the place where you see that this current instantiation of capitalism, we can call it neoliberalism, is about concentration of power and inequality and hierarchy and patriarchy and white supremacy and all of these things that have sort of solidified into this very strong oligarchy, into this corporate control model that we now have. That's the same hand that feeds the philanthropic enterprise, that this money is, you know, ill-gotten gains from these same means. And so as soon as you try to talk about it or critique the structure, you know, funds get pulled and people start getting interested and worried and concerned about your work. You get attention. And we used to run an activist collective called The Rules, and part of it was an economic alternative think tank, and part of it was a narrative organization that was supporting social movements. And as the movements wanted to express what was actually happening, you know, saying the obvious things like capitalism creates climate change, capitalism creates inequality. These are not externalities, like the economists like to say. These are the logical outcomes of the existing system. The funders that would not necessarily support social movements, but support an organization like ours, because even though we were supporting them, we were based in the West and we spoke their language and we went to their schools, and they were our friends basically till we were involved in campaigns and moments that started to call out the structure. And it was easy for us to see the connection and also the boundaries and the barriers and the guardrails that were imposed on us by philanthropy. And then what we would also notice is that this sector institution called philanthropy, which is supposed to be, you know, benign, and once the funds are yours, they're supposed to, you know, it's not like they're hiring NGOs, right? Their mandate is to give out these funds because they're also receiving tax breaks from it, and it's public benefit money. But that they very much started becoming managers, as if they were, you know, hiring an advertising agency or something like that. You know, everyone became their clients because there's a psychology around money and an animate force around money that even the good people within the system get sort of pulled into the orbit of the thought form of what it is to be somebody who wields money and power. And so as we started noticing these things, Lynn and I said, well, maybe there's a meditation around philanthropy and wealth and money that we, as someone who worked in a foundation and in philanthropy and someone who had to interact with them for 20 years, that we could bring that meditation to bear on capitalism itself and expose a kind of more structural historical perspective, as well as maybe point towards coordinates of possibility. Not that we have an answer, not that post-capitalism is a destination, but maybe point to a map of what a potential journey with transition pathways could be to post-capitalist realities. That they're not some kind of you know, future temporal state that will happen after the fall of capitalism, but there's ways to enact the values of post-capitalism. There's ways to get there now as part of a process. And so that's how we ended up with this book, Post-Capitalist Philanthropy.
Very cool.
I'm sure Lynn could add to that.
Yeah, Lynn.
Maybe I'll say a little bit about what we're invoking with post-capitalism, and then we can see if Elnor wants to build on part of what we're calling late-stage capitalism or capitalist modernity or neoliberalism. You'll hear us use different terms to suggest, and perhaps the starting point is to say, as I invoke even those words, neoliberalism, late-stage capitalism, capitalist modernity, post-capitalism, it's an acknowledgement that these are not just structures out there. They're not just the orientation for the political economy, for the polity, for the cultural. I invoke culture to suggest that these also are all living within us as well. Like all of these structures, in other words, it's to suggest that there's an inner capitalist within all of us. And it lives through thought forms, what we'll talk about often as mimetics, like narrative structures. It lives within our logic of scarcity and hoarding. It lives within, I would offer, it lives within the ego itself and how it is so attached to the realm of form. and materialism and certainty and comfort. Of course, we have all been indoctrinated in it through schooling, through, I would even dare say that we're here speaking English, through the hegemony of the English language that is a language of nouns much more than verbs, and this commodification and transactionalizing that lives. So with that, I'll suggest something about what we're invoking with post-capitalism and see if there's more to say about what we're specifically talking about with neoliberalism and what we're trying to offer as the ontology that we're all swimming in, the ontology being the very way that we perceive and see reality itself, the lens by which we see, or Elnor will often say it's the waters we're swimming in or the air that we're breathing that we're trying to point towards. So post-capitalism, the first piece about that is for us, it's not an ism to come after capitalism. So it's not a binary logic of kind of old culture, new culture. It's to suggest that whatever it is that we're invoking needs to be informed by the conditions of capitalism itself. And as I was just suggesting, that's much more than market exchange. It's not just how I got my groceries or how I pay for rent. It's much more about the historical conditions of what created late stage capitalism and neoliberalism, and locating ourselves within that historical analysis and understanding what gives rise to white supremacy, colonization, the continuation of extraction, exploitation, and domination, and to have an analysis of that, but not to stay just in the analysis of that, where many want to stay within the material realm of, okay, let's understand the historical conditions that give rise to where we are right now in this moment. It's to then suggest that in the same way that academics spoke about postmodernism, it's informed by capitalism. But again, we're not trying to suggest that there's like some utopia over there that we're going towards. And we're trying to disrupt our habituated patterns of mind that does think very in binary terms. And so what Elnor was referencing before is sometimes we'll call it a set of values. I sometimes will refer to it as a state of being that is rooted, instead of competition, and cooperation, in solidarity, in nonviolence, in compassion, in interbeingness or interbecomingness. And we don't just say those in platitudes. It's like, how do we actually find our way back into kinship, into reciprocity, into right relationship with all of life? And perhaps even I would say the right relationship with life and death. And if part of why I invoke that is values or states of being, is because it's an ever ongoing praxis or practice for that to arise. And when something that we're living in some of those states of being or those values arises, it's not, again, that temporal kind of it's more, we might inhabit a realm that we could offer as post-capitalist in orientation, in way of living, in a culture that we might start to see within our, I'm going to say organizations, because it's closer to organism rather than institution. And then the other thing about how we invoke post-capitalism is to recognize that while the second half of our book is called Healing Wealth in the Time of Collapse, so we speak about the collapse and the meta-crisis, and it's to honor that there are many peoples across this planet who their world collapsed. They lived through the meta-crisis with first contact with colonial forces, with the whatever it was that their world, their worldview, their lands, their ways of being, their ways of living. In some cases, they themselves were just annihilated, and in others, their ontologies, their cosmologies were. And yet, some have endured. And so it's really honoring those who have continued to live post-capitalist realities throughout time, and or others like in Rojava or the Zapatistas or others who are really putting those values or those ways of being as an organizing principle for how they're living right now. Maybe I'll pause there and see if there's a question or if if it's for Alnor to say a little bit more about the way that neoliberalism is like organizing everything. I leave it to you, Amit, to direct us. Yeah.
I think that would be a really a conducive way of proceeding, is to kind of maybe loop back and take a look at our current moment. I did want to kind of double click on a couple of things that felt or like pop stood out to me as I was listening to you explain the work that you're doing now. But there's something when you were introducing yourself, Alnor, you spoke about a responsibility that you have coming from a maybe villainized part of the story narrative that we're in now, like both with the Trumpian sort of that level of sort of Christian conservative aspect that you were invoking, Lynn, and also the Muslim world. So there's also sort of that other aspect of responsibility, the burden of it, but also the ability to actually respond to something. So it seems like you're very well placed sort of on that edge of the inside of the outside of the system. There's also something around, you spoke about this as a map, and it felt like this is, in my perception, it's a map that really takes us to the edge of something. So it's a really, and that's what really caught me at the speech at the Local Futures Conference, is that in, I think, 20 minutes, you went through the depth and the granularity of the picture that you painted of where we are at the moment, and sort of those hinge points that you were able to highlight. Really brought me to the edge of, there was like almost as if I could see beyond it, almost as if I could see how the post-capitalist realities are here right now. So I just wanted to invoke that as well, because I hear your work being about closing the distance, not distancing further from. It's like really stepping into and being with what's here now so that it can be metabolized or composted or something like that. And maybe those are projections from my side, but that's how it lives in me.
And maybe linking the kind of the role of religion and then also the role of economy, right? Before we go in, because even this idea of like villainization, it's like from what perspective, right? From the perspective of of let's say the Arab world, the West has been the primary driver of evil on the planet, right? And I would say the majority world has a lot of sympathy with that perspective, especially in the last 500 years of Western imperial colonialism and genocide, and then even more so in the last 100 years since World War I of, let's say, U.S. Anglo or U.S. Euro foreign policy, right? The assassination of democratically elected leaders around the world for Western interests and all of that. And then from the West's perspective, Islam is the ultimate other, right? And Islamophobia is at the sort of all-time heights and all of that. But there's something deeper that's been happening in the background, right? So in 300, 400 AD, when the Romans adopt Christianity as the state religion of the empire, this is the beginning of something very profound that happens, where religion is no longer a spiritual practice, but it's an institution that justifies the machinations of state. And we've just had the continuation of that ever since. And so what ends up happening is we sort of muddle these things as somehow that there is actually an Islamic world and a Buddhist world and a Christian world, but actually there's one governing ideology, and that's neoliberalism. That is a growth-based, debt-based economy. And people are using religion as alibis and justifications for the imperial expansion, but at the end it comes to the self-interests of nation states. And we demarcate where our self-interests are by religion, by ethnicity, by race, by skin color, etc. But those are just alibis for greed and extraction. What's really happening is that we have this kind of accelerator, the snowball effect of late-stage capitalism, right? So we've had these kind of acceleration moments where this if we look at the inception moment of modern empire, of course, there was empires that existed before, but modern empire that's still the dominant empire in the world today, which is the Christian Western hegemony in the world. It sort of starts at this period of the Romans adopting Christianity. And then we have this kind of acceleration of that during the time of the Crusades and the time of nation-state delineation, right? The treaties of Westphalia in Europe and what have you. And then you have this like super acceleration that happens around the time of the Renaissance and the so-called Enlightenment and Scientific Revolution. And it speeds up even more. The extraction machine just amplifies. And then you have the Industrial Revolution, where that extraction now is happening on an industrial scale, initially in Europe and then through colonialism and imperialism all over the world. And what happens is at the same time you have the Industrial Revolution and we have this colonial expansion of Western Europe, Western European empires go around the world and they basically sever our ability to be self-sufficient. It's first done in Europe through the enclosure movement, and then it happens in the rest of the world, right? We used to have many ways of acquiring goods and services: hunting, bartering, gifting, trading, you know, all forms of sort of reciprocity. And basically that is severed. And what is imposed is European debt-based capital at first, right? Whatever the empire was, Britain, Belgium, France, you name it, Germany in certain places in Africa, like Namibia. And all of a sudden there's no other way to acquire goods and services. We were recently talking to an Alaskan elder who came to visit, and she was saying how she has to pay $2,500 a year to fish on her ancestral waterways in Alaska, you know, just to have the permits and all of that. So she has to go work some bullshit job in the debt-based system in order to pay for a thing that's their ancestral right and is part of their livelihood, right, of that culture. And so, and this is where it sort of all interconnects, right? Like, we can say that we're not political. We can say that spirituality and politics have nothing to do with each other, but all of these things are enmeshed. Politics, economy, spirituality, religion, they're all part of the same operating system of neoliberalism, because our very life force and our livelihoods are determined by this made-up thing of debt-based capital, of fiat currency, currency issued by the state, right? So where we grew up, what we do for a living, how much leisure time we have, what our parents did for a living, the racial, ethnic, socioeconomic background of our neighbors and our friends, all of that is being determined by capital. And so our lives are mediated by capital, including our spiritual lives, right? Go to a remote place in Tibet, who decides who gets to meditate in the cave and who stays in the ashram? Who decides what kind of food is served in the ashram? Where passengers and the guests are coming from, right? And what capital they're bringing and who's investing in the infrastructure of the build of these things. And are they state-sanctioned temple or are they not a state-sanctioned temple? All of this is being determined by capital. And every government in the world right now, it doesn't matter if we're talking, you know, so-called communist China or so-called socialist Ecuador or neoliberal United States or United Kingdom or what have you, they're all in the same business, which is GDP growth. They're all in the neoliberal game because we have a growth debt-based system, which means money is incepted at debt. And in order for that debt to be paid back, you have to grow the global economy. And economists tell us you have to grow the global economy at a minimum of 3%, not to have stagflation or recession. And so we're all bound in this hamster wheel of infinite growth that is creating climate change, that's creating ecological breakdown, that's creating species extinction, that is creating perpetual war, that is creating these kind of resource battles that are only going to increase, and the mass migrations that are only going to increase as a result. So there's a direct connection between who we think the so-called villains are, the nation state, whether they're religious nation states, you know, theocracies like the Christian theocracy of the United States or the Muslim theocracy of Saudi Arabia, the state religion, state power are completely enmeshed within the political economy of neoliberalism. And there is no other political strategy in the world except each nation state growing their GDP and global GDP growing as a result. And so that's what we're within. And the media will portray it, and individual actors and players will portray it as if there's something else happening, clash of civilizations. But at its highest level, this is actually a zero-sum game that we have invented based on debt-based capital and the divvying up of resources.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. All right. Cool. That's a good starting point for where we could go next. So I'm wondering, because I mean, we talked a little bit about sort of ego, and you both alluded to in sort of the I being a treacherous unit to start, you know, sorting yourself under or from or something like that. And there seems to be a similar application of that structure and the, you know, that I is a unit in that goes into the, or like the family unit is a unit that goes into the capitalist sort of, and then how we structure that. And maybe it has to do with sort of the Jungian sort of individuation thing that sort of pre post and those aspects. Maybe it has to do with something else, but I'm curious about sort of where, either for you personally or like in terms of like the work that you've been doing as you're approaching this work, where do you see where do the cracks usually form? Like what are the weakest points in this kind of hall of mirrors that we've formed? Like where can we start remembering? I don't know if that makes sense as a question, but
yeah.
It felt
you
like
want to start, Lynn?
Okay.
Do you want me to do a
I was starting in the pause in a way by really, really listening to the question rather than quickly reacting and responding. And for me, that coming back to a deep practice of listening is one of the first places of the cracks and the pause. And in that, what came was perhaps to speak a little bit about how Norse spoke about how capital is mediated through this project of whether it's religion or the nation state or the growth of GDP or those who kind of are, there's many that these days are kind of trying to do social good through the lens of impact investing, entrepreneurship, personal growth, all of these different things. And where my reflections were going is that if we don't understand and I don't just mean understand in a cognitive sense, I mean actually interrogate where this lives in our body and our ways of seeing and viewing and how we approach everything from relationships to how I pick up a cup. If we don't understand that we're kind of caught in this, what we often talk about as the unholy trinity of materialism, rationality, and separation, kind of being three coordinates, that's kind of locking us into this way of perceiving, this ontology of where we are in late stage liberalism, capitalism. We can't even approach where the cracks are. And so maybe just a word on that, and then I'll see if Elnor wants to expound upon that, and then we can come back to kind of what you're speaking to of the cracks. I would almost suggest are some of the practices or the praxis that we sit within, that we kind of let the, if I could say it this way, like let the checkmate of where we are in late stage capitalism, that we're kind of stuck in it, kind of rub with another way of being and knowing that's calling to us, and let that friction open up a crack. So when we say this unholy trinity of materialism, separation, and rationality, I'll say it simply, and perhaps Elnor can say it much more elegantly. materialism is, you know, we see everything in its reducible parts. The entire kind of scientific paradigm is all that there's somehow that we can, if we just understand the relationship of these parts, we get down to isolate the thing in a materialist construct. It's the very gaze by which we see the world. We look at everything from I'm seeing this computer or this phone in a material way. It's a relationship of part to part, and I am entitled to understand the relationship of those parts. And this is where I think we get caught in the scientific paradigm of, you know, we can get a theory of everything, of all understanding of everything within the material world. It's still where I recognize that when I'm kind of in a default mind, I'm still seeing a lot through the material realm. And it's seen as inanimate objects that I am entitled to manipulate, to extract, to commodify, to control, to do whatever I want because it's material. And it's also the very way that I perceive it all. Separatist is one that we can all recognize. There's still a sense of I am a separate being, and we look at everything through a lens of separation rather than through a lens of interconnectedness. And, you know, there's a lot more I could say, but about that, but just to slow down, to recognize, and maybe whoever's listening right now to just slow down and recognize where this thought form of separation lives and where it has gotten us to. If I live every day as I'm separate, I mean, we're every day hearing of the mental crisis of isolation, of people feeling, you know, separated, and it's all mediated through, we can blame technology or whatever, but if we go to those roots, those are consequences of an ontology that's kind of locked us into this. And then the rationalism is, we've been speaking about the project of religion or the project of extraction, but there's a way in which we see the whole thing through the highest way of knowing, in a way, in the church of positivism or the church of science right now, is that we prioritize rationalism. You know, I'm on countless calls and things, and I'm listening. And right these days, you know, it's everything, and it's important work, but it's still a rational gaze when we're still speaking about reparations through working through critical race theory. We're still using the rationalist logic rather than opening up to other ways of being and knowing that's coming through. And there's a lot of philosophical, there's many, many philosophers who've spoken to this. There's historical reasons for this. It's everything from, you know, the project of the church also brought in the printing press. There's a certain technology of mind through the literacy that we have, through words, through symbology, that reinforces the notion of rationalism, that reinforces the notions of materialism and even separation, just through, you know, we went back to the grammar structure of I know, and the way that we're really caught and that this lives inside of us. So if we don't actually understand what we're caught within, this kind of unholy trinity that is also replicated within neoliberal logic, I could do the same way that corporations reinforce those, that organizations, whether it's a social impact good or whatever, you're still reinforcing those same logics. If we don't understand that, then we can't actually get to the crack, in a way. And we're not just saying understand in a kind of cognitive esoteric, it's actually like through an embodied cognition. And also recognizing it's the way that the manner by which we're approaching all. I'll pause there and see if Elnor wants to say more about the unholy trinity, and then we could perhaps move more into the crack question. Yes.
I just wanted to sort of also like, but there's something here that seems to be teetering on the edge that you didn't say, but it has to do with our relationship to death, perhaps, and like this idea that sort of continuation is good and discontinuation is bad. So that seems to also reinforce this dynamic that you're speaking to. Sorry, Elnor.
Yeah, no, I think Lynn bringing up this unholy trinity is sort of central to the kind of story that we're weaving, and the tapestry that we're weaving here together, which is around this idea of ontology, right? The manner by which we approach how we see the world, right? Onto, the Greek for vision or beingness, right? The isness of reality is shaped by separation, materialism, and rationalism, if we've been socialized in the West. That's how we see the world. And that ontology shapes, you know, every aspect of our lives, which is why when we started and started talking about and painting the picture of neoliberalism and saying that there's no spiritual tradition right now that is outside of neoliberal constraints, because there's no culture that's outside of neoliberal constraint right now, right? Unless you're an uncontacted tribe in the Amazon or Papua New Guinea and you're not using debt-based capital to you know, build infrastructure and put food on the table and what have you. If you're completely outside of capitalist modernity, which is rare or almost impossible, because this socio-cultural construct has become so totalizing. And so part of your question around cracks and sort of what we're reaching for is where is freedom as well, right? Where is and how much does the sort of personal I identity access freedom in a culture that has been totalized and dominated by extraction, by separation? And there's a definition of colonization I really like from Chief Niniwa, who's one of the Huniquin chiefs, Brazilian Amazonian tradition, where he says, coloniality is a cognitive, spiritual, neurological impairment that makes us believe we are separate from the living world. And so our ontology is a form of colonization, right? We've been so deeply colonized into believing that we are these separate beings, and the whole culture reifies that, right? So we meet someone at a party. It's like, what do you do for a living? We have to show our passports at, you know, checkpoints, and our license and our name, and, you know, so we have this entire culture that has elevated the small s self. When we look at mystical traditions or indigenous traditions or cultures, you know, worthy of the word culture, what they do is that you're born into a culture that orients you, right? That says, here's why we're here, and here's where we're going, and there's elders, and there's rites of passage, and initiation, and ceremony, and an entire arc that orients you to the context. Now, in the context of late-stage capitalism, there's various wisdom traditions in the world who have tried to orient us to this moment. The Iroquois prophecy, for example, of the seventh fire, right? This is the moment that we have to choose between destruction and some form of rebirth. The Hopi prophecy of the sixth sun. The Buddhists call this the age of degeneration. In the Vedic traditions, this is the Kali Yuga, the dark ages. And part of the reason they do this is to say, well, you have to first understand the time in which you were born. Because if you're not contextually sensitive, you will not be contextually relevant. There's a line in the Vedas that says, if you do not know you're born in the Kali Yuga, you're of no use to the Kali Yuga. And this is the problem with kind of the Western New Age enthusiasm, right? Everyone is like so gung-ho excited about their ascension, right? If they just do like one more Joe Dispenza meditation, they're somehow going to access their pineal gland and, you know, become these like infinite beings that can manifest their Ferrari. And it's a kind of derision of the kind of context we're in, which is, you know, as the old abolition line goes, none of us are free until all of us are free. There's a different context and moment we're in right now, which is, and it requires contemplation, right? To, you know, if we spend a quarter of the time really understanding the political economy and the spiritual karmic implications of neoliberalism and colonization and what they've done to us, we would probably have a much higher, let's say, ability to access states of enlightenment. We would also probably have a political revolution already. But we've somehow separated the political and the spiritual. And as a result, we have this neoliberal spirituality where everyone is just, you know, out for their own personal liberation. And there's this deep internalized belief that just like the invisible hand of the market, there's somehow the invisible hand of God, that if we all just pursue our selfish interests, somehow this equilibrium will rise, right? That progress will continue as this arrow ever forward. And actually what's happening is the opposite, right? We're having right now, 200 species a day are going extinct, 1,000 times the baseline rate of normal extinction. We are in the midst of the sixth great extinction, right? We have created this Anthropocene. We have created this meta crisis that we're in, and it's no one's fault, but it's everyone's responsibility, because there is like almost a distributed fascism that's been created, right? We lawyers think that they're just serving people. People in ad agencies think they're being creative. People at the Gates Foundation think they're doing social good in Africa, but they're all actually just contributing to the increase of inequality, the increase of patriarchy, hierarchy, violence, white supremacy, et cetera, right? And so it's been distributed amongst many people, and we all are just trying to put food on the table, and everyone wants their Amazon.com package delivered on time, and you know, their Uber Eats dinner to come, and you know, and has to take care of the things they need to take care of. And so really understanding this moment of what it means to be enmeshed in distributed fascism, to be enmeshed in late stage capitalism. Part of what we're suggesting is perhaps our liberation lies in understanding that. So we don't continue to replicate the monstrosity of separation, materialism, and rationalism. And that requires a shift in ontology, which you could also map to a shift in consciousness. And that's not an easy thing to do. It's not the turn of a key. It's not like, well, now, you know, I've got the Buddhist transmission, or I got a darshan, or, you know, that now I'm going to know what to do. It's ongoing spiritual political practice.
Yeah. Yeah.
And maybe picking up on the piece that you were asking about this death, and more on what this ongoing spiritual political practice is, or what sometimes we talk about as justice plus ontological shifts, with a plurality and a recognition that it is an ever ongoing practice, is we see a culture that's really obsessed with the linear notion of progress. You know, it's like we have the notion of temporality, of like bad, worse, what comes after in some way. And you see it even in the realms of whether it's biohacking, whether it's like obsession with longevity. It's not to suggest that, you know, desire for health in of itself is somehow negative or bad, but it's somehow like we have the entitlement to do this. And I see it within the structures. Like, I worked for many, many years on schooling, so we could say the same. And I joke sometimes that I couldn't make much inroads with schooling, so I moved on to capitalism. But in both senses, they're you know, they're caught in the house of modernity. But in both cases, I feel like the structures and the myriad manifestations of those structures, we keep trying to add life support systems to keep this entity going, these entities going, rather than actually understanding and coming into right relationship, or perhaps even falling apart and recognizing the humility that we don't actually understand what the power of life and death actually is, and finding our way back into right relationship with that. Perhaps that would allow us to enter into other ways of being and knowing that give the courage and the fortitude and the simplicity and the humility to start hospicing some of these structures, some of the ways of being and knowing, some of our organizational forms to allow something else to come through. But it starts in a way with us catching where we're really addicted to certain progress narratives. Like, today was bad, tomorrow might be better. I did wrong now. And then it gets caught in ego. It gets caught in our notions of efficiency, of everything, like excellence, instead of, there's one thought form that we often work with, that a line came through of, we are entitled to nothing and entrusted with everything. And so what does it, where do we actually feel that we're entitled to something? Some of us feel it's an entitlement to, you know, owning a home, to having children, to whatever, to having 2,000 calories a day of food. And we're not in the right relationship with entrustment. So it's not to say not to have a house or not to have family or not to have caloric intake, but it's the manner by which we're approaching that we're trying to point towards, the kind of slowing down enough so we can be in relationship and perhaps.
She's gone.
So funny internet today. So maybe, do you want me to answer while we're waiting for her? Or
yeah, sure, please.
And your editor's going to have a little bit of a hard time doing the mishmash. So maybe to go back also to this point around death and linking it to culture, Terence McKenna, the ethnobotanist and philosopher, one of his famous lines, it was, culture is not your friend. Culture is not your friend. And Clifford Geertz, the great anthropologist, used to often talk about culture is a set of collectively agreed upon delusions. You know, that these sort of webs of meaning are collectively agreed upon, but that doesn't necessarily make them right. And when we have a culture as impoverished as the Western culture, and you know, I'm not obviously talking about the beautiful aspects of Western culture and, you know, high art and music and mysticism and Gnosticism and all the beautiful aspects, but I'm talking more about the kind of live, work, consume, die paradigm, you know, the kind of McDonald's, Walmart, globalized culture of neoliberalism and this moment of capitalist modernity. The impoverishment of this culture, what ends up happening is, it's not a culture that can contain the sort of bigger S self, right? Our kind of relationship to whatever you want to call it, divine emergence, Allah, the cosmos, the expanding universe, what have you. It's purposely trying to do the opposite. And when you are not connected to something bigger than you, when you're not connected to a grander cosmos, the individual life becomes inordinately important and unnecessarily so. And so we have this clinging onto the individual life and the individual ego, right? You have this kind of Silicon Valley, Ray Kurzweil, sort of deeply uninitiated, lost young male set that sort of follows these people who are looking for immortality, right? They want to live forever. I forgot one of these kind of tech folks who's like doing all this health and wellness stuff. One of their lines is, don't die. Right, because they never die or something like that, you know. Like they believe that we're so close to the singularity that we just have to like live out this generation, and then, you know, we can live forever and upload our consciousness to the AI. And it's so deeply frightening because mm-hmm. they're not connected to the cycle of death and life, right? And so they don't know how to honor life, and therefore don't know how to honor death. And I kind of put, like, you know, Tim Ferriss and Joe Rogan and Jordan Peterson and this kind of new alt-right. And it's hard to even place them, right? Because it's not just about young, lost white males, you know, following these people. There's something deeper that they're tapping into that is seductive to all of us, which is that kind of lost adolescent being within us that is not oriented to life and death, that has not been initiated, that has not sacrificed blood and sweat and village life in order to be somebody. That's not anchored and rooted into this kind of grander cosmos. What ends up happening is that we sort of transpose that life force and that energy onto the self-perpetuation of the individual self. And so it's about, how do I game the system? How do I do the 4-hour work week and extract as much as I can and do the least amount and win awards and become, big and strong and without any sense of, well, what have I been entrusted with? This line that Lynn said is actually a Sufi proverb, which is often attributed to the great mother speaking to her children. It's Allah saying, you have been entrusted with everything and you are entitled to nothing, right? I think it goes the other way, sorry. You are entitled to nothing and entrusted with everything. And so the first part, you are entitled to nothing. We're not entitled to our 3,000 calories a day and our protein shakes and our keto diets and our job at Google and living forever, right? But you are entrusted with something else. You are entrusted with this holy relationship to the living world and being part of the ecology of that living world. And these things are totally enmeshed. Yeah, so sort of death becomes central to this, right? Because if you do not have reverence for the cycle of life, you are going to treat death as this unfortunate encumbrance on your entitlement to perpetual extraction, as opposed to death as the source material and gift that feeds life. And it belies this lack of initiation in our culture and the deep sense of entitlement that's at the root of the Western project, right? That same sense of entitlement that justified colonial slaughter and extraction and going out in the world and being hubristic enough to believe that you're entitled to take what you want. So then the last thing to say then to connect the why we talked about neoliberalism, it's linked to spirituality, and how it's mediating our lives. It's linked to the broader culture, which is then linked to death and dying, but it's also linked to our understanding of consciousness. We have a very neoliberal understanding of consciousness. In the Western tradition, when we look at, for example, what's happening with neuroscience, the last 30 years of neuroscience has been obsessed with this idea of the hard problem of consciousness, which is essentially, how does mind, consciousness, emerge from brain if it's just a set of synapses firing? It's the machine metaphor. Our brains are these machines, yet somehow we can't figure out how consciousness comes from this brain machine in the Western tradition, right? And, after 30, 40 years of the best neuroscience and, quantum computing and quantum mechanics and all of it, what they've come to is this, it's epiphenomena, which literally means they don't know. Right? Mm-hmm. Epa, it's circling around phenomena, right? It's an emergent, quote unquote, emergent property, right? And the problem is that the culture is incepted into an ontology that by definition asks the wrong questions. So the idea that consciousness is simply an epiphenomena of the individual's brain is neoliberal science. Right, which is the extension of this atomization of the individual. And it's also deeply related to our understanding of death, because if the individual dies, that is the end of that individual's consciousness. So we therefore must upload our consciousness. And another way to see it, let's say another ontology, if we take the Sufi cosmology, for example, the idea of idealism, right, that all there is consciousness. Consciousness is the ontological primitive. We are in the mind of Allah. We are Allah becoming self-aware. We are consciousness becoming self-aware. Then we don't have the hard problem of consciousness. And we have a different spiritual material responsibility and obligation to the world. It's not about collecting experiences or acquisition of material things, as is the logical outcome of a materialist rationalist culture, but it's about becoming the metacognition of the divine, you know, becoming aware of the becomingness of God, of the divine through you. It's about having experiences that shift consciousness itself. And these are very different ontologies, but they're deeply rooted in the question you're asking. And when we really examine why is the culture, this life-destroying culture of neoliberal capitalism, and it's no longer a Western culture, it's become the globalized culture, right? That, you know, even in traditional societies, even in the Arab world, that at one point really led the only powerful alternative, you know, this idea of third world socialism and the non-aligned movement that was really spearheaded in you know, the 40s to, let's say, the 70s in the Arab world, has slowly dwindled away as the Euro-US empire has brought in Saudi Arabia and Qatar and these oil-producing countries to be part of the extension. And of course, you know, Israel plays its role as the kind of military arm in the Middle East for the empire. And so on the face of it, these are all theocracies. They're all these kind of religious states. But at their core, what they are is neoliberal states. And they're neoliberal states pushing a very particular ontology about individualized consciousness and therefore individualized acquisition and individualized entitlement. And you can see how all of this is connected as we weave this web in this way. And our spiritual attainment, if that is the goal for certain people and for seekers who want something more than you know, that the shallow taste of the dust in their mouth of materialist rationalism, we have to go to that context. We have to really deeply contemplate and understand that context in order to say, how do we show up differently? How do we cast different ontologies? How do we embody ourselves in ways that are of service to this moment and deepen our entanglement within the collective co-liberation of not just humans, but the more than human world? It's our interbeingness and our interbecomingness that's more valuable than the idea of any individual consciousness making it. There's this Sufi line that's often attributed to Rabia of Basra, where she says, and it's considered a heretical line, where she says, the body is the prophet, the ummah is the prophet, the desert is the prophet. And essentially what it means is there's a nested hierarchy that's happening here. It's not just about the individual consciousness, but it's about consciousness throughout the entire body. The body itself is consciousness. It doesn't reside simply in the brain in some kind of Cartesian Newtonian fashion. Consciousness is in our gut biome. It's in our cells. It's in our epigenetics, right? It's in the electromagnetic force and field that comes and emanates from the body. And so the body is the prophet. And of course, in traditional Islam, there could only be one prophet. And so this is heretical in that sense, which is you yourself are a fractal reflection of divinity, and it's held in your body. But then she goes on to say that the ummah, which is the community, is the prophet. That the community of people that you are surrounded with, human and more than human, are what keep you accountable to your becomingness. Because you could slip into the delusion, as Niniwa said, or the impairment of colonized separation. But the role of the community, the role of culture, the role of spiritual practice was to embed you in something bigger than yourself. And then the third part of it is the desert is the prophet, is to say the ecology is the prophet, right? That this individual body of consciousness is embedded in a broader community of consciousness, which is embedded in an ecology of consciousness. The desert holds consciousness. The rainforest holds consciousness. The Gaia whole is consciousness. The solar system is consciousness. The galaxy, dark matter, dark energy, the expanding universe, they are consciousness. And so the idea that the desert is the prophet is our ecology is reflecting back to us who we are, how we treat animals, how we treat mycelial plant systems, lichen, forests, oceans, rivers. That is a reflection of who we are. Mm. And of course, if we look at the plane of destruction that's been created by capitalist modernity, there's a spiritual indictment on us collectively as a species. And so there's something very powerful in seeding consciousness outside of the small S self individual, but seeing it as the holy ground, the kind of the ontological substrate of all reality.
Yeah. And there's something, I mean, it's a much used story right now, but it seems to be what I'm hearing you speak to. It's like the pointing, like one aspect of like the entitlement. I love that you brought that in because it's such, you know, it's been coming back. And then also this idea of the sort of the uninitiated. I mean, in a way, like I jotted down, it's like, that's the gift of failure. It's like that initiation kind of comes around there somewhere. That's like the resistance that you get. And there's like a way that we have to kind of self-medicate failure right now. I mean, you don't do it voluntarily, but you are exposed to it. And so the failure will break you and then like give you an opportunity to shape, perhaps to take another shape or to break through this veneer of something. So unless you've had that, it's very difficult, I think, to get there. But it's like, in other traditions. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Totally. Yeah. No, you're right. Like that was the whole point of initiation, right? That when we look at these wisdom traditions, that they would create these contexts where the entire culture's purpose was the transcension of subject-object, right? And when you can transcend subject-object, even temporarily, you understand your place in a broader whole, right? Yeah. That's why non-ordinary state, yoga, tantra, mantra, yantra, dance, silence, psychedelics, all of it, its entire purpose is built around this notion of the temporary dissolution of small s self in order to merge into the greater whole. And we don't have that as a culture, right? We have trauma as the kind of uncontained sort of non-initiation, we could say. Great, we got Lynn back. Okay, so Lynn can maybe answer this last question and then we could... Okay, so Lynn, so just to give you the update, so...
I cut out somewhere mid, I was talking about entrustment and entitlement. And I was like, I think I'm no longer there.
So I did entrustment and entitlement, did linked kind of spirituality, politics, consciousness, the idea of the individual consciousness, uploading, living forever, dying. And we kind of closed with like the importance of initiation and transcending small as self as like, but worthy cultures do. So maybe you could just do a little tie-in and then, we could.
Yeah, I'll do a little, because that's what I was feeling from both of you. It's like, it is sort of this parable of the man that looks for his keys under the, street lamp. It's like, that's kind of the way that we tend to approach even the people that are on the project of quote unquote overcoming capitalism are we're in the street lamp, and that is still, where the culture lives. Those are the things that we can see. And so what I'm hearing you speak to, and you were invoking it a few times, then like this whole idea of it's not about necessarily seeing, it's a much fuller sensing, or it's a much deeper being and invoking and a courage maybe to sink through something which is there, and letting it open us, and as we are opening it, it's like the reciprocal aspects of things as well. But I don't. So I'm curious about maybe that's a good. There are two things that are rummaging around in my head, and one is the final chapter of your book, like the Trinity, those three things, the invitation to how we could perhaps start navigating differently or finding ways. through what we're speaking to now. And then there's a curiosity, and maybe that could be left for people to just find in the book. But the option, or like the other triangle, the one that's not the unholy trinity, what would that be? And maybe those even come, line up together.
I'm sitting with all this work on practicing. How do we shift our gaze? How do we shift the way we perceive reality? How do we shift the way that we are in relationship with one another, with the water that we drink, with the air that we're breathing, with whatever it is that we are consuming? And I don't just mean material goods. I mean everything from the food to information. How are we with this? And Elnor and I talk about transition pathways, and it's not just for philanthropy. It could be for philanthropy NGOs. It could be for those who are doing social enterprise, but it's a recognition that the way that we're, the path that we're on right now, if we're really intending to get out of the patterns and the path of domination, extraction, entitlement itself, that there's some path for us to walk. And that whatever that path is, that path of transition, it is going along, whatever we do, so to speak, it's going along with this practice, this ever ongoing practice of onto, if I could even invoke it in an ing verb, onto shifting. It's to suggest that the manner by which we approach, the consciousness by which we're approaching, comes alongside of whatever it is that we're doing, whatever action it is that we're taking. So if we're working to, if we really do feel to be in right relationship, whether that's with the lands that we live on, with the watershed that we're in, with growing food in the ground, with making an offering to the world, that we're actually doing that in alongside the onto shifting. And for me, a lot of that comes to a core of how are we in relationship with life force itself? Like, how are we actually, in a way you could say, this is where I think this culture of initiation or culture of trauma comes in really precisely, which is, I feel like I, in my life, and perhaps through my epigenetics and through the lands that I was born upon and the culture, it's been a process of cement removal. Did you guys lose me again? I have a feeling you lost me again.
Okay. Maybe I'll finish that question and say bye. Because I want to answer your question very directly, but also say that this is not necessarily an answer, right? So it's direct, but not necessarily an answer, which is my sense of the antidote means, let's call it that perhaps, to materialism is animism, is to see the world as alive. And to see our role in a broader ecology of beingness and consciousness, as we talked about with this, with the Rabia statement aphorism. The antidote to rationalism is relationalism or relationality. I like this line by David Abram where he says, there is no such thing as truth, there's only the quality of relationships. He says it in The Spell of the Sensuous, whereas instead of trying to have this dominant objective truth with a capital T, that truth is, there's simultaneous subjective multiple ontologies that get negotiated through relationship, right? When I'm negotiating, let's say, with mycelial, mycelial is going to know more about the soil than I'm going to know about soil. If I'm negotiating with a soil scientist, that soil scientist is going to have more information than I am, right? My perspective is not as, not necessarily relevant, but it's not as, it doesn't need to be so enforced. We can hold it much more lightly, right? There's no stringency that is required to that truth in that context, in that relationship. And it requires dialogue, as does this relationship with the animate world, right? That this is kind of always the answer, is reciprocity, dialogue, a sort of deepening, a humility, a willingness, an understanding of entrustment on both sides, on all sides. And then the antidote to separation being interbeing and collective co-liberation, right? That none of us are free until all of us are free. That the idea of the separate self is a very persistent illusion, but an illusion nonetheless. And so Lynn and I think of this as a kind of Merkaba instead of a, you know, an alternative trinity, that we have to superimpose them, right? And so separation, materialism, and rationalism aren't going to go away. The reason they're so persistent and is that there is a way in which we see the world and in which a certain ontology is useful. It just can't be the only ontology. And then we superimpose that ontology with this idea of animism, relationality, and co-liberation, or interbeing is another way to see it, yeah. And have them live together, and there's spaces and cracks in between that. And again, you know, this is not like a framework that is some kind of definitive framework. It's just a set of coordinates that could be useful in certain contexts, and we hold it that lightly. And so, Elena, I'm so glad you're back. I'm going to have to just say my bye and say, and then you'll be able to finish and then do the same. Thank you so much, Ami, for having us and hosting us. And we hope it's useful to you and your community. And we'll just keep the dialogue going and see where we go.
Yeah, it's lovely. Thank you, Elnor. Yeah, I appreciate it.
So thank you for dancing with. I got a message saying that the large ants had eaten through one of the fiber optic cables.
Oh, really?
So Elnor had rats and I had ants. We are in the more than human world of lack of entitlement to bandwidth.
Yeah.
That's
what we get for invoking animism, right? Yeah.
Exactly.
Just stayed in the rationalist. Yeah.
Exactly. I think what I was saying about like back into the life force and kind of the culture and the way that in this life, you know, navigating with a history of trauma or an epigenetic lineage has often felt to me like something to the equivalent of cement removal. It's almost like cutting through these layers of what actually blocks the relationship with life force itself and the humility that's required in removing the cement and recognizing the calcification innerly, the calcification of ideas, the calcification of addiction to, whether you want to say scarcity, and I would say hoarding. I think they're actually of the same source, and they're rooted, it feels like, in fear almost of the power of life force more than the a place of true reverence or honest reverence to the best of our ability. And so, as Elnor was speaking about the unholy trinity, or perhaps like a offering around the Merkaba, it's what we're speaking of the walking to these transitions with an ongoing practice of onto shifting. That it's not like we're going to leave all of this behind, but it's what else comes through, what else are we cultivating that shifts the manner by which we're approaching, that shifts the consciousness, that shifts us into right relationship. And so this is where, as you were speaking to the last part of the book, where we feel that collectively, we as a species, we as a humans living within the conditions of the Anthropocene, that we're in a very deep moment of actually doing a lot of unlearning so we can actually find a way to be in a very high state of surrender. And surrender is, you know, often people will say let go, and it's like trying to release something that we're gripping onto. And it's beyond, I feel like surrender is a little bit of a beyond a let go. But if we start with a practice of let go, there I would say that it's a let go of, in the Western traditions, or Western culture, we're very addicted to comfort. we're very addicted to certainty. We feel entitled to know. We feel entitled to know the answer, to know the solution, to know the thing that I'm to do right now, today. And then what the consequence or what the outcome of that will be. There's a very deep gripping, and if we're honest, an addiction. And, you know, I've heard many years ago, I was on what we called a pilgrimage. It was called Walking Water. And we were walking this water pipeline, bearing witness to where the waters were stolen from Paihunadu, Owens Valley in California for LA. And this isn't one of the first gravity fed aqueducts, where one of the first kind of water thefts happened through that to build LA essentially. And at that time, it was the first time that I heard it this way, that when someone was asking about what the biggest conditions of the Western mind and what got us into this mess, one of the indigenous men from those lands who was walking with us spoke to comfort and said, you know, it's not just that we want to sit in this chair, that we want the home, that we want the car, that we want the food, we want the air conditioning, but it's even comfort in we want the information in the way that we want it. And what we know actually from adult learning is that we don't actually learn when we're in the place of comfort. We learn when we're in discomfort. We need times of rest and we need that, but there's something that really to disrupt and be in the discomfort that allows us to enter the gateway of let go and into surrender. And then if we can be with that, and as we let go, you know, perhaps catch some as we're falling, that this brings us to a level to a humility to recognize that we as a species are at a threshold moment, that we're at this very profound moment of what are we going to not just do, but how are we going to be with these cascading crises? How do we not like close our hearts to the many wars and famines and growing amounts of war that are going through ideology and lands and genocide? How do we be with that in this moment of surrender and like what Elnor was referencing, mass extinction, which includes us, you know, if that many species are dying? And can we recognize, like anyone who's done an initiation ceremony, there's always this moment you get to of a threshold. And it's a way of kind of saying there's no going back. There's cozying up to a death of a way of a sorts. And to recognize that we're at this deep threshold moment is, can we traverse this threshold? Can we find a way through that allows us to move back into right relationship with life and death, that allows us to walk each other into the unknown? So our very invocation of post-capitalist realities or post-capitalism is an honoring that we're walking to a place we don't know where the destination is. We just recognize that whatever it is that we have been doing, that we're doing, the constructs of late stage capitalism, of modernity, of how it lives within us and how it influences the way our ego approaches all of it, is in a way that needs to be surrendered, traversed, and re-entering the continuum of life and death that always is and has been. This is where it's like beyond time and space and includes it. And it's just our Occidental culture that has separated us out of it. And if we perhaps can stitch ourselves back in it, we can find the humility and courage to walk each other. And we say each other with this notion of kinship and reciprocity and reparations into the unknown.
That's absolutely beautiful, because it's the way that I hear it is that everything that you would need, it's not out there or somewhere else or after you've done X, Y, Z or something. There's a way to start inhabiting that place, that sort of the overlapping trinities or whatever, and these three, the surrender, the traverse, and the re-entering into the continuum of life. I mean, that's possible right here, like with your next breath. And it's not it requires something of us. There's a requirement Yeah, it's you won't get there by cruising through, you know. You will you will have to apply yourself at least and figure out why you want it, I think. I really appreciated this somewhat messy because of technological reasons and also because of other reasons, I think, but really beautiful conversation. And thank you for bringing it to such a beautiful close. I appreciate you taking the time, both of you. Mm-hmm. And I hope to continue this conversation in appropriate forms.
Us as well. Thank you very much. Al-Noor often speaks to the notion of shukran within his tradition, within the Sufi lineage. And it's a nod to gratitude beyond the you and me that is giving the thanks. And I invoke that because thank you goes back full circle to where we began as who is the I that's here, who is the you. And it's the collective you, the collective gratitude and appreciation that brought us into entanglement and into the dance of this particular conversation. So with the deep spirit of shukran and gratitude, I offer, hack.
Thank you so much. Yeah. And I'll just say it as well, so that if you've gotten to this point, there will be links in the show notes to both where the book can be found and where you can find out more about the two of you's work. I'll have made sure to put that there because it's, as I've said a couple of times, there's a precision and a penetration of aspects of these realities that we're living in. So anyone with a longing to look beneath or beyond, maybe, I think this is a really nice way to start approaching the edges of the map that we're living. At least for me, it has been. So thank you. Thank you so much.